Usually when you look at a map, there's this inherent expectation of precision, right? Like you look at a property grid or a county line or a national border, and the lines are just sitting there on the paper, completely binary. You know, you are either in one territory or another. It feels very engineered and like permanent.
Oh, absolutely. It provides this comforting illusion of order. I mean, we really prefer our human geography to be clean, visible, and legally undisputed.
Yeah, exactly. But the moment you start digging into the history of global land rights and specifically indigenous sovereignty, that map just completely dissolves. You realize pretty quickly that you're looking at a legal and historical landscape that is, well, it's incredibly murky.
Right, because the lines on the paper rarely tell the true story of the ground underneath them.
Exactly. So today's deep dive is going to unpack an immense history of how those lines were drawn in the first place, how they were contested, and how they're currently being like actively erased and redrawn. We are diving into the global movement for indigenous land sovereignty. And the hook here for you listening is that this is not just some, you know, dusty history lesson about old treaties sitting in a museum.
No, not at all. It's incredibly current.
Right. Returning land to indigenous stewardship is currently acting as a colossal force in modern global conservation. I mean, we are going to look at everything from artificial intelligence monitoring the Amazon rainforest to the legal systems of New Zealand granting actual personhood to entire ecosystems.
Which represents a fundamental paradigm shift, really. We're
Yeah.
moving from conversations that are merely about, who holds a piece of paper claiming ownership to redefining how land is perceived, managed, and legally categorized in the modern world?
So, to understand this modern land back movement, we really have to start at the foundational collision. When European powers began expanding globally, they didn't just bring ships and weapons, right? They brought an entirely new legal framework. I guess my question is, how did they justify taking the land in the first place, legally speaking?
Well, the justification relied entirely on fabricated legal fictions. I mean, the most consequential of these was the doctrine of discovery. This concept emerged from 15th-century European decrees, specifically these papal bulls, which basically declared a terrifyingly simple rule.
Which was what exactly?
Basically, that any land not already inhabited by Christians could be discovered and instantly claimed by Christian European powers. And hand in hand with this was the concept of terra nullius, which is a Latin term meaning nobody's land.
Wait, so a European explorer could step off a boat, look at a territory inhabited by literally millions of people who had, you know, complex societies, agricultural systems, trade networks, and just legally declare the space empty.
Legally, yes. Because the inhabitants were not Christian, and because they didn't organize their property according to like European models of fenced individual ownership, European law basically deemed them legally invisible. The land was considered vacant for the taking.
That is a staggering level of cognitive dissonance. I mean, truly. And the wildest part to me is like, this wasn't just some abstract philosophical flex by a king. It became embedded into the actual bedrock of modern property law.
Oh, deeply embedded. It
Yeah.
shaped the entire real estate system of the United States, for example. To see the mechanics of this, you really only need to look at the landmark 1823 Supreme Court case, Johnson v. Emmentosh.
Okay, break that down for us because this case is wild.
It is. So two men claimed to own the exact same piece of land. One of them had bought it directly from the Piankashaw Native American Nation. The other bought it from the United States government. So the Supreme Court had to decide, who had the valid title.
Right.
And Chief Justice John Marshall ruled that Native American nations did not actually own their land. He said they merely had a right of occupancy.
Wait. So the highest court in the land just formalized a 400-year-old religious decree just to settle a local real estate dispute.
Effectively, yes. Marshall's argument was that because the United States had inherited the right of discovery from Great Britain, the federal government held the true underlying title to the entire continent. That single decision reduced indigenous ownership to mere occupancy. It permanently embedded the doctrine of discovery into American property law.
Wow. But while European powers were arriving with this doctrine of discovery, indigenous peoples were operating under their own incredibly sophisticated pre-existing legal frameworks, right? They didn't view the landscape as some blank slate. They viewed it as a deeply managed environment governed by international treaties.
Exactly. The contrast in paradigms is just striking. Western colonial law viewed land as a commodity. It was something to be subdivided, bought, sold, and exclusively owned by an individual to the exclusion of all others.
Right, the fences.
Right, the fences. But indigenous legal systems, broadly speaking, functioned on a completely different logic. Land wasn't property in that sense. It was a shared ecological responsibility.
A brilliant example of this from the sources is the Dish with One Spoon treaty tradition, which was utilized by the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and other nations. The mechanics of this treaty are just so elegant.
They really are.
So the geographic territory, like the hunting grounds, is the dish, and everyone shares it with a single spoon. There are no knives allowed at the table, meaning no bloodshed over the resources. The rules of the treaty dictate that you only take what you need, you ensure something is left for the next person, and you share the responsibility of keeping the dish clean.
It was an active binding agreement of shared responsibility for natural abundance. It was the complete antithesis of drawing a hard border and declaring everything on this side is exclusively mine. And what's often overlooked is that when European powers first arrived, they actually engaged with and respected these indigenous frameworks out of sheer necessity.
Yes, like the 1613 Two-Row Wampum, or the Gaswenyada. This was a treaty between the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch, and it wasn't written on paper. It was recorded in a wampum belt, which functioned as a highly formal, legally binding document.
And the visual language of that wampum belt tells you everything you need to know about the agreement. It consists of two parallel purple rows of beads set against a background of white beads. One purple row represents the European ship carrying their laws, their religion, and their people.
Okay.
And the other row represents the indigenous canoe carrying their laws and ways of life. The white background represents the river of life. The agreement was that these two vessels would travel down the river side by side in peace and friendship forever. Crucially, though, the parallel lines never intersect.
Oh, that's such a great detail. The lines never cross.
Right. It was a formal diplomatic agreement of mutual non-interference.
It's basically an early blueprint for peaceful, sovereign coexistence. And this kind of cross-cultural diplomacy wasn't limited to North America either. We see similar early recognitions in Northern Europe with the 1751 Lap Codicil.
The Lap Codicil. That's a fascinating piece of legal history. Sweden, Finland, and Denmark, Norway were formalizing their national borders. But they attached this codicil to the border treaty to explicitly protect the Sami people.
What did it do, exactly?
It legally recognized the rights of the Sami to continue their cross-border reindeer herding. It acknowledged their seasonal migration patterns, their land use, and their livelihood rights. It was this explicit European admission that indigenous reality simply superseded newly imposed political borders.
Which makes the subsequent era of dispossession so incredibly frustrating to look at. The analogy that comes to mind is this. The doctrine of discovery is like someone walking into your fully furnished house, declaring they discovered it, and completely ignoring the complex neighborhood association rules you've been operating under for centuries.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Because you have the two-row wampum, you have the dish with one spoon, you even have the 1764 Treaty of Niagara, where the British explicitly ratified agreements through indigenous diplomatic practices. So my question is, why did colonial courts eventually develop such convenient amnesia and just ignore these pre-existing treaties?
Honestly, it comes down to the brutal mathematics of power and demographics. In the early 1600s, colonial outposts were highly vulnerable. They desperately needed trade agreements, military alliances, and peace treaties just to survive the winter.
Right. They didn't have a choice.
Exactly. But as settler populations exploded, and as the balance of military and economic power decisively shifted, the legal interpretations shifted right along with them. Treaties that were originally negotiated nation to nation were suddenly reinterpreted by colonial courts as mere domestic contracts.
Just downgrading them.
Yeah, downgrading them. Recognizing the sovereignty implied in a wampum belt would have delegitimized the rapid, aggressive territorial expansion that the settler states were now fully capable of executing.
They simply changed the rules of the game the absolute moment they had the upper hand, which leads us into a critical phase of this history, because the imposition of colonial law and the theft of land wasn't, like, a quiet affair. The narrative that indigenous people passively faded into history is completely false.
It's one of the pervasive, damaging myths of colonialism. The reality is characterized by centuries of fierce physical defense. If we look at the American Southwest, for example, the Pueblo Revolt of 1680 stands as a masterclass in coordinated resistance.
Set the scene for us there.
Well, Pueblo communities were facing suffocating Spanish colonial rule. This encompassed forced labor, heavy taxation, and severe religious repression. Under the leadership of a man named Pope, they orchestrated a gigantic synchronized rebellion.
And the logistics of that coordination are just mind-blowing to me because they didn't have a written language common to all the different pueblos, right? And they were spread out over vast distances, so they used runners carrying knotted cords made of deer hide.
Right, the knot system.
Yeah. Each knot represented a day. Every morning, the leaders of each pueblo would untie one knot, and when the last knot was untied, they all rose up simultaneously.
And the precision of it was absolutely devastating to the Spanish. The Pueblo people successfully expelled the Spanish colonizers from the region entirely. They restored their own control over their land, their religion, and their governance for over a decade. It was an enormous victory. And
Incredible.
we see this scale of resistance globally. In the Andes in 1780, Tupac Amaru II led a colossal indigenous uprising against Spanish abuses, forced labor systems, and land seizures. It mobilized tens of thousands of people and literally shook the foundations of the Spanish viceroyalty.
Then you have Tecumseh's Pan-Indigenous Confederacy in North America around 1810. Tecumseh was fundamentally challenging the colonial real estate model. He argued that land belonged collectively to all native peoples, and therefore, no single tribe or leader had the legal authority to sell it to the United States. He built a mammoth alliance to halt U.S. expansion based on that exact legal philosophy.
We also really must highlight the Mapuche people in Chile and their execution of the Arauca War. They fought the Spanish colonial forces and later the independent Chilean state for literally centuries.
Centuries. That is unbelievable endurance.
It is. The Mapuche adapted rapidly to European warfare. They incorporated horses, they changed their tactics on the fly, they forced colonizers to retreat, they defeated Spanish governors, and they maintained sovereign autonomy over their territories far longer than almost any other indigenous group in the Americas.
But the machinery of state-backed dispossession was just relentless. When treaties and negotiations failed, the colonizing states just passed laws to codify the theft. I mean, the United States passed the 1830 Indian Removal Act, which was, let's be real, a bureaucratic mechanism for ethnic cleansing. It legally enabled the forced relocation of native nations from their ancestral homelands in the southeast to territories west of the Mississippi.
And following that era of removal, the strategy shifted to dismantling the concept of collective ownership itself. This is crucial. In 1887, the U.S. passed the Dawes Act, which is also known as the General Allotment Act. The mechanics of the Dawes Act were incredibly insidious.
How did it work?
So it surveyed communally held reservation land and broke it up into individual allotments, usually around 160 acres per head of household.
Which, sounds on paper like they are granting property to people, but it was actually a trap, right?
A completely devastating one. By forcing individual ownership, they shattered the communal structure of the tribes. Furthermore, once every tribal member was assigned an allotment, the government declared all the remaining millions of acres on the reservation to be surplus.
Ah, surplus.
It's
a
a
very convenient word.
Exactly. And that surplus land was then immediately opened up and sold to white settlers. Through the Dawes Act, tens of millions of acres were transferred out of indigenous ownership without a single shot being fired. It was theft by paperwork.
Though when paperwork wasn't enough, they absolutely used military force. You have the Battle of Little Bighorn, where Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho forces militarily defended their treaty rights against U.S. incursions into the Black Hills. You have the agonizing Nez Perce Flight of 1877, which was a fighting retreat over 1,000 miles as they tried to escape to Canada rather than be confined to a tiny fraction of their homeland.
Yes. But as the frontier eras closed and the 20th century approached, the sheer physical presence of settler states made open warfare increasingly difficult. But the resistance didn't stop, it evolved. The physical defense of homelands transitioned into highly coordinated civil and passive resistance.
The story of Parihaka in New Zealand is a stunning example of this transition. In 1881, long before the world knew the name Gandhi, a pacifist Maori settlement became the epicenter of nonviolent resistance against land confiscation. They didn't take up arms. They used spiritual leadership and peaceful action, like actively plowing the land that had been confiscated and given to settlers and removing the survey pegs.
Just constantly disrupting the infrastructure of the theft.
Exactly. They maintained this peaceful disruption until colonial troops literally invaded and dismantled the settlement.
And that strategy of making the resistance highly visible and politically inconvenient carried forward powerfully into the modern era. Consider the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in Australia in 1972. Activists planted beach umbrellas and set up tents directly on the lawns of the Australian Parliament in Canberra.
Just right there on the lawn.
Right there. They essentially declared themselves aliens in their own land to protest the government's refusal to recognize Aboriginal title. It was a brilliant piece of political theater that forced the nation to confront the issue daily. They couldn't look out the window without seeing it.
We saw similar pressure cookers bursting globally. The 1973 Wounded Knee standoff in South Dakota, where the American Indian movement occupied the town to demand federal investigations into broken treaties. And in 1975, the Maoriland March in New Zealand. Wina Cooper, who was in her 80s at the time, led thousands of people marching the length of the North Island to Parliament. Their slogan was, "Not one more acre."
Such a powerful moment.
It really feels like this physical, unignorable presence was building up everywhere. But protests and occupations are one thing. When did we start seeing this pressure successfully force the colonizers' own court systems to actually change their laws?
That tipping point is really the defining characteristic of the late 20th century. The physical resistance created enough political friction that the judicial systems could no longer maintain their historical amnesia. We began to see gigantic legal breakthroughs that actively chipped away at the doctrine of discovery and terra nullius.
Let's talk about those courtroom battles, because this is where the map actually starts getting legally redrawn.
The watershed moment is undeniably the 1992 Mabo case in Australia. For over 200 years, the Australian legal system had operated on the absolute fiction of terra nullius. But a man named Eddie Mabo and the Miriam people from the Torres Strait Islands spent a decade fighting a relentless legal battle to prove their continuous traditional ownership of their lands.
But how do you legally prove that to a court that, you know, doesn't want to listen?
It's incredibly difficult, but they did it by demonstrating an unbroken system of traditional law and custom regarding land boundaries and inheritance that predated the British arrival. The High Court of Australia finally looked at the evidence and agreed. They issued a ruling that legally recognized native title and struck down the doctrine of terra nullius.
Wow.
It was an immense turning point. The court essentially admitted that the foundational premise of Australian property law was a lie, which opened the door for native title claims across the entire continent.
It is so fascinating to see the law forced to catch up to reality. We also see historical treaties being pulled out of the archives and recognized as active binding law in the U.S. The 1974 Bolt decision is a huge example. Tribes in Washington state had signed treaties in the 1850s guaranteeing their right of taking fish at all usual and accustomed grounds. But for a century, the state had restricted their fishing, prioritizing commercial and sport fishing.
And Judge George Bolt examined those treaties not as ancient relics, but as living, breathing contracts. He ruled that the treaties entitled the tribes to 50% of the harvestable catch.
Which is huge on its own.
Right. But even more radically, he affirmed the tribes as co-managers of the state's fisheries alongside the state government. It was a monumental shift. The treaty suddenly demanded shared power over the regional ecosystem.
And if we look north to Canada, the 1997 Delgamuukw decision fundamentally changed the rules of evidence. The Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en nations were claiming Aboriginal title to a vast area of British Columbia.
Yeah, the legal friction in Delgamuukw was really about proof. The colonial courts historically demanded written, European-style documentation to prove ownership. But the indigenous nations instead presented their adok and kungaks, which are their sacred oral histories, songs, and dances, as evidence of their continuous jurisdiction.
And the court accepted that.
They did. The Supreme Court of Canada made a colossal ruling. They validated indigenous oral history as legitimate, legally binding proof of Aboriginal title. They ruled that oral traditions had to be placed on an equal footing with historical written documents.
That completely shatters the colonial monopoly on what constitutes truth in a courtroom. And this legal awakening didn't just stay national, it scaled up to international human rights tribunals.
Yes, the precedents really began to stack up. In 2001, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights heard the Awas-Pingi case against Nicaragua. The court ruled that the state had violated the rights of the Mayanya community by granting a logging concession on their ancestral lands without their consent.
That's a huge deal.
It was the first binding international tribunal decision to uphold collective indigenous land rights. It ordered Nicaragua to actually demarcate and title the communal lands.
And that created a domino effect for other communities utilizing international courts, didn't it?
Precisely. It paved the way for the Saramaca victory in Suriname, where the court ruled the state could not issue logging and mining concessions on tribal territory without consultation. It also laid the groundwork for the Sarayaku ruling in Ecuador. In that case, the state had allowed a foreign oil company to explore on Kichwa territory. The court ruled heavily in favor of the Sarayaku, reinforcing the standard of free, prior, and informed consent, or FPIC.
FPIC, right.
Right. It established that states cannot simply bulldoze into indigenous territories for extraction without meaningful prior consent from the communities.
Okay, I mean, these legal victories are incredible on paper, but I have to push back here a little bit. A court ruling in a capital city, or a judgment handed down by an international tribunal in Costa Rica, doesn't automatically stop a logging crew deep in the Amazon or a mining company in the Andes. If the state just refuses to enforce the ruling, what good is the piece of paper?
That is the exact friction point that defines the modern era. You're completely right. Legal precedent is a shield, but a shield doesn't hold itself. The rulings from the 80s and 90s were vital, but they were largely theoretical without implementation, enforcement, and unrelenting on-the-ground organizing. And that gap between theoretical legal rights and actual terrestrial reality is what birthed the modern land back movement.
So we are seeing a transition from asking for recognition in court to demanding the physical return of the land itself. And the examples of this happening right now are genuinely inspiring.
We really are witnessing the tangible transfer of immense tracts of territory back to indigenous stewardship.
Just recently, for example, the Washaw tribe regained 10,000 acres of land near Lake Tahoe to create the Wellmelte Preserve. This isn't just about ownership. It is about the long-term stewardship of sagebrush, juniper, and pine forest ecosystems. The Tula River Indian tribe successfully regained 17,000 acres in the Sierra Nevada, which allows them to focus on cultural restoration and reintroducing Tule elk. In California, the Yurok tribe has been systematically regaining ancestral homelands to restore vital salmon habitats and revitalize their cultural fire practices.
And the critical distinction here is that these are not just, you know, symbolic apologies. They are literal transfers of management authority and ecological responsibility. And communities are pursuing highly creative models to achieve this. Look at the Hakavian Yefaleshev intentional community in Alabama.
Oh, the reverse gentrification project. I love this example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is a Maskoki-led initiative where they are acquiring rural land and reclaiming it for language revival, regenerative agriculture, and eco-village living. They are actively bringing sturgeon back to the rivers. They are tying the physical protection of the land directly to cultural survival and self-determined community building.
And it is really worth noting that these modern creative returns are built on the legacy of earlier, highly symbolic victories. Like the return of Blue Lake to the Taos Pueblo in 1970, the U.S. government had taken the lake, which is deeply sacred to the Pueblo, and incorporated it into a national forest.
And they tried to just pay them off. Right.
Yes. The government offered them monetary compensation to settle the claim, but the Pueblo refused the money. They fought for decades until President Nixon finally signed a bill returning the lake and the surrounding land. It proved that monetary payouts could never substitute for the land itself.
However, while we celebrate these returns, we have to look soberly at the enduring economic structures of dispossession, because it's not all solved. A prominent investigation in the material we are discussing highlights a phenomenon known as trust issues in the United States.
The mechanics of this are actually shocking to me. How are states still profiting from taken land today?
Well, in 15 states, there are vast tracts of state trust lands. These lands were granted by the federal government to the states, often using territory taken from tribal nations. The mandate for these trust lands is to generate revenue through timber, mining, agriculture, or leasing to fund public institutions like public schools, universities, and hospitals.
That is wild.
So the foundational financial systems of these states are still actively profiting every single day from the historical dispossession of indigenous lands.
It is a really sobering reality check. The dispossession isn't just history. It is actively funding today's infrastructure. But let's pivot to the land that is successfully returned, because this is the core question for me. When land is placed back under indigenous management, what actually happens to the ecosystem? Like, does the environment actually notice the change in management?
The environment responds dramatically. And this brings us to why the land back movement is acting as a mammoth solution for global conservation. The data shows that indigenous stewardship directly challenges and often completely outperforms older exclusionary models of environmentalism.
Because the mainstream environmental movement has a pretty dark history of its own regarding land rights, doesn't it?
Yes, unfortunately. The history of conservation is deeply entangled with colonialism. Historically, the Western conservation model relied on a philosophy known as fortress conservation.
The idea of the pristine, untouched wilderness.
Precisely. The flawed logic was that to protect nature, you had to build a fortress around it and remove the human presence entirely. This completely ignored the reality that these landscapes had been actively managed and shaped by human interaction for millennia. Consequently, fortress conservation became a mechanism for severe dispossession. In the name of protecting the environment, indigenous peoples were violently evicted.
The examples in the sources are heartbreaking. The forced removal of the San people to establish the Central Kalahari Game Reserve in Botswana. The Eneroi people in Kenya being evicted from their ancestral lands around Lake Bogoria to create a wildlife tourism reserve. Or the Shipibo people in Peru who found their traditional territories absorbed into a regional conservation area without their consultation or consent, which instantly criminalized their traditional ways of life.
It was essentially land seizure painted green. But thankfully, the paradigm is finally shifting toward coast stewardship and the establishment of Indigenous Protected and Conserved Areas, or IPCAs. Instead of fortress conservation, we are seeing the rise of rights-based conservation.
A spectacular example of this is the Mimal Indigenous Protected Area in Arnhem Land, Australia. We're talking about a colossal 1.6 million hectare area. And it isn't managed by some state bureaucracy. It is managed by the Mimal Land Management Aboriginal Corporation. They connect conservation corridors, they protect ancient rock art, and the territory is patrolled by Indigenous rangers.
We see a parallel model functioning beautifully in Canada with the Guardian Watchman programs in British Columbia. First Nations guardians are out on the water, actively patrolling their coastal territories. They monitor wildlife populations, they enforce conservation rules, and they manage resources. It's highly effective on-the-ground stewardship that creates local jobs rooted entirely in cultural responsibility.
But the most radical shift in conservation law might be what happened in New Zealand with the 2014 Te Uirua Act.
Oh, it is a breathtaking piece of legislation. So Te Uirua was a national park. The government completely removed it from the national park system. But they didn't just transfer the title to the Tuho people. Instead, the forest was granted legal personhood.
Wait, so the forest legally owns itself?
Yes. It is an entity with its own rights. It is governed by a board composed largely of Tuho representatives who do not act as owners, but as the voice of the forest, reflecting their deep ancestral relationship with that land. It fundamentally alters the Western concept of property. I mean, you cannot exploit something that has the legal right to exist and thrive.
That is mind-bending. Just conceptually, it changes everything. But I do want to bring up a piece of pushback regarding how we discuss Indigenous conservation globally. There is a statistic you see everywhere on social media. Indigenous people protect 80% of the world's biodiversity. The science actually debunks that specific number, though. Why is it dangerous to rely on that stat, and why don't we actually need it to prove the point?
It's a really critical distinction. The 80% statistic originated from a misinterpretation of spatial data that just went viral. Relying on unsupported statistics gives opponents of land rights an easy target to attack the credibility of the entire movement.
Right. They can just say, your numbers are wrong, therefore your argument is wrong.
Exactly. And the truth is, we do not need to exaggerate, because the actual rigorously peer-reviewed data is overwhelming. Studies consistently show that legally protected indigenous lands hold some of the world's healthiest, most resilient tropical forests. They sequester enormous amounts of carbon. In some regions of the Amazon, they hold nearly all the protected carbon.
So the ecological outcomes of indigenous governance are demonstrably superior to state-run parks. And that superiority isn't magic. It is rooted in traditional ecological knowledge, or tech.
Exactly. Traditional ecological knowledge is not static mythology or, like, historical trivia. It is an applied, deeply observational, adaptive science developed over thousands of years of interacting with specific ecosystems.
The clearest example of this, and something that Western science is furiously trying to catch up to, is cultural burning. For over a century, the Western forestry model was defined by absolute fire suppression. Put out every single fire immediately. But tribes like the Karuk and Yurok in California have been fighting for decades to revive their cultural burning practices. And this isn't just a California phenomenon. The Zarente people in Brazil's Cerrado region are actively using indigenous fire knowledge, combined with modern satellite data, to manage controlled burns.
The mechanics of fire suppression versus cultural burning are absolutely fascinating. Complete fire suppression is highly dangerous because it allows dry brush, dead wood, and fuel to accumulate unnaturally on the forest floor. When an inevitable spark occurs, especially now with climate change intensifying droughts, that accumulated fuel creates catastrophic, uncontrollable megafires that literally sterilize the soil and destroy the canopy.
It is exactly like putting a heavy lid on a boiling pot of water. The pressure just builds and builds until the entire thing explodes, whereas indigenous cultural burning acts like a pressure relief valve.
A highly calibrated relief valve, yes. Cultural burning utilizes low-intensity, frequent fires. These fires clear out the dangerous underbrush fuel without killing the mature trees. The ash acts as a fertilizer, returning nutrients to the soil. And actually, certain seeds literally require the heat and smoke of these specific fires to germinate.
Wow.
Yeah. So by actively managing the landscape with fire, communities protect their villages from megafires while simultaneously promoting immense biodiversity.
And this concept of active sovereign stewardship extends far beyond the forests, too. It includes the water.
Indigenous land sovereignty intrinsically includes marine and freshwater ecosystems. The Guayhenanis Marine Agreement in Canada is a prime example of this. The Haida Nation successfully negotiated cooperative management that extends from the old-growth forest on the islands right out onto the ocean floor, protecting the entire interconnected marine ecosystem from extraction.
We are also seeing indigenous leaders pushing for a formal seat at the table for the UN High Seas Treaty. They are arguing that you cannot separate marine conservation from indigenous knowledge and governance, even in international waters. And the wildlife protection happening on the ground is incredible. Look at Dominique Bakaba's work in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
His approach is revolutionary. He works to protect the critically endangered Grauer's gorillas. But he doesn't do it by building a fortress. He does it by advancing the land rights of the indigenous Batwa and local communities. He recognizes that the people who have lived alongside the gorillas for centuries are the ones best equipped to protect the forest corridors they rely on.
Or the Miccosukee tribe in the Florida Everglades. They are actively utilizing their resources to buy back and protect land, securing vital wildlife corridors from development. It all circles back to that foundational concept of shared ecological responsibility.
However, despite this immense progress in conservation, legal recognition, and ecological management, we really have to examine the modern front lines. Because the reality is that indigenous territories are under heavier pressure today than at almost any point in history.
The extractive threat is brutal right now. Defending these territories is incredibly dangerous work.
The statistics regarding violence against environmental defenders are staggering, and indigenous peoples are disproportionately targeted. Land defenders who stand in the way of illegal logging, mining, or agribusiness are facing extreme, organized violence. We see tragic outcomes like the disappearance of Julia Chuño, a Mapuche land defender in Chile who is actively resisting aggressive logging operations. Decades earlier, the world saw the assassination of Chico Mendes in Brazil, who organized rubber tappers alongside indigenous peoples to defend the forest from cattle ranchers.
But there are also incredible victories against these extractive giants. The Dongriya Khan people in India are a perfect example. A mammoth international corporation, Vedanta, wanted to build a bauxite mine that would have destroyed the Neyengiri Hills, which are deeply sacred to the Dongriya Khan and ecologically vital.
The Dongriya Khan engaged in a relentless campaign. Oh. They took the fight all the way to the Indian Supreme Court. And in a landmark decision, the court ruled that the local village councils, the Gram Sabhas, had to be consulted.
And what happened?
Well, all 12 village councils voted unanimously against the mine, successfully halting the project. It was a huge victory for local democratic control over extractive industry.
But the threat isn't just coming from traditional mining and logging anymore. One of the most surprising twists in global geopolitics right now is the threat of false climate solutions.
Right, this is the concept of green colonialism. The global north is desperately trying to transition to green energy, you know, building electric vehicles, solar panels, and wind turbines. But that technology requires an enormous amount of critical minerals like lithium, cobalt, and copper.
And a vast percentage of those unmined minerals sit directly beneath indigenous territory.
Exactly. So the push to save the climate is creating a new wave of intense mining pressure on indigenous lands. Similarly, carbon offset markets are allowing major polluters to buy carbon credits by claiming to protect forests elsewhere. If a carbon offset project or a lithium mine is established on indigenous territory without free, prior, and informed consent, it is simply a new form of colonial extraction just painted green. The global north's demand for clean energy cannot be satisfied by sacrificing indigenous territories once again.
And technology is playing a highly complex, double-edged role in all of this. On one hand, you have incredible tools at play, artificial intelligence, satellite imagery, and drones are being deployed by indigenous communities to monitor illegal logging, wildcat mining, and unauthorized fires in the Amazon. It empowers a small team of forest guards to patrol vast, dense territories efficiently.
It is a powerful tactical advantage. But the other edge of the sword is the threat to indigenous data sovereignty. UN experts and digital rights advocates are really sounding the alarm on this. If Western tech companies or outside conservation NGOs provide the AI and control the servers, they are extracting an enormous amount of traditional knowledge, mapping data, and ecological information without true consent.
So they are helicoptering in, vacuuming up the data, and retaining ownership of it.
Precisely. Indigenous communities are demanding to be the decision makers over their own data architecture, not just unpaid data sources feeding algorithms owned by Silicon Valley.
It all comes down to control, autonomy, and resources, which brings us to a stark statistic regarding global climate finance. The international community spends billions of dollars annually to protect nature and mitigate climate change, but less than 17% of those funds actually reach indigenous communities directly. The vast majority of the money is eaten up by intermediary NGOs, international agencies, and state governments.
Which is incredibly inefficient when the data proves that indigenous communities are the most effective stewards of biodiversity. With major climate summits approaching, like COP30 on the horizon in Brazil, indigenous leaders are aggressively shifting this financial dialogue.
Leaders like Chief Rayoni in Brazil and the unified indigenous guard networks across the Amazon are demanding structural change to the global financial system.
They are making a very pragmatic argument. They are the ones physically defending the forests. They're the ones putting their lives on the line against well-armed, illegal loggers and miners. Therefore, they must have direct access to climate funding to support their patrols, their mapping, and their communities.
Makes complete sense.
Right, they're telling the United Nations and the World Bank, you cannot save the Amazon from a boardroom. You have to directly empower the people who live there. They are moving the conversation past symbolic participation, demanding direct financial autonomy, and secure, legally recognized land demarcation.
We have covered a colossal amount of ground today. We started with the doctrine of discovery, the legal fictions of Terra Nullius, and 17th century wampum belts. We traced the physical resistance of the Pueblo and the Mapuche, and saw how that evolved into the gigantic legal breakthroughs of the Mavabon and Bolt decisions. We've looked at the modern land back movement physically returning vast ancestral lands and how traditional ecological knowledge like cultural burning is providing a scientifically backed alternative to fortress conservation. And we've seen how modern land defenders are utilizing AI while fighting against green colonialism and demanding direct climate finance.
The overarching synthesis of all this history and science is clear. The global movement for indigenous land sovereignty is not just an exercise in historical justice or righting the wrongs of the past. It is, unequivocally, the most pragmatic, scientifically supported, and necessary solution we have for global climate resilience and the protection of the biosphere.
It fundamentally reframes how we look at that map we talked about at the beginning. So, to you listening right now, I want to leave you with a question to consider. Think about the land you are standing on or driving through right this second. Who were the original stewards of that space? And if they were given the authority to utilize their traditional ecological knowledge today, how might the management of your local environment radically change for the better?
And building on that paradigm shift, I will leave you with this final thought. We discussed the Te Uira Act in New Zealand, where a rainforest was granted the legal rights of a living person. What would happen if the rivers, the mountains, and the forests in your own backyard were legally recognized, not as property to be subdivided, owned, and extracted from, but as living entities with the inherent right to exist, flow, and thrive? If a river could sue a corporation for polluting it, how would that fundamentally alter our entire global economy?
That is a staggering thought experiment to end on. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. Keep questioning the map, and we'll see you next time.